we're all familiar with something we call the Bill of Rights, a list of 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution that protect some of our most cherished individual freedoms. Those freedoms are protected against violations by the national government, certainly, but also by state and local governments. That is, your local state police or city police can't violate your First Amendment rights any more than the FBI can. But it was not always so. In fact, according to an 1833 case that we're going to discuss today, the Supreme Court had decided that the Bill of Rights did not protect us from the state governments. The case was called Barron versus Baltimore, and today we're going to tell you all about it. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about Barron, Baltimore, and the Bill of Rights.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
William Davenport Mercer is a great guy. I met him through my association with the University of Tennessee's Law School, where I've had the privilege of teaching for the past 7 or maybe 8 summers now. Every summer, I send an email around and ask all of my colleagues, hey, you work on anything interesting? You want to come on the radio show? And this last summer, Bill said, yeah, sure. I've got a really interesting new book coming out. It's all about Barron versus Baltimore. Yeah, me too. Barron versus Baltimore is not exactly what you would call a sexy case. Barron versus Baltimore, as you'll see, involves boats and wharves and nasty, smelly streets in the city of Baltimore and the attempts of the city to clean them up and what happened when they did. But it's extremely important in American constitutional history because all the way back in 1833, it was an open question as to whether the Bill of Rights protects us not just against the national government, but against state governments as well. And in that case, John Marshall, the Chief Justice of the United States, and a majority of the court decided that the Bill of Rights does not protect us against the states. Think about that for a moment. A state police officer or a state government in any of its guises could trample all over your First Amendment rights or your Second Amendment rights or any of the rights protected in the Bill of Rights. How could that be? I mean, today that's not true. Well, it's not true because of something called the 14th Amendment and the Civil War. We'll get to that subject later. What we're going to talk about today is the significance of John Marshall's decision, not just with regard to the Bill of Rights, but with regard to what we think of a right as being, our very conception of what a right is. It turns out that Barron versus Baltimore is a really interesting case, much sexier than I'd thought. Here's Bill Davenport.
Hey, well, technically William Davenport Mercer, but everyone calls me Bill. Every now and then you'll meet a William that goes by William, but that's not me. I'm a lecturer here at the University of Tennessee. I split time between the history department and the law school, so mm-hmm. I teach a little bit in both, and I'm a legal historian.
You've actually got a background in the law that then segued to academe. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I kind of took the long way around. I came out of undergrad, went to law school straight through, and then started my career doing commercial litigation for a private firm in Tampa, mm-hmm. Florida, and did that for about 4 years. I then took a gig as a legal aid attorney at the University of Florida. They have a great office. I didn't know they had these sorts of things before I started. Student legal services. The clientele is students at the university, and they fund your office partly through activity fees. And then, you know, they fund the gym and speaker series, and big schools are able to fund attorneys. And so I took that job, and I did that for 10 years, and that was great. It was quite different than commercial litigation, mm-hmm. you know, which is very heavy, very technical, a lot of motion practice, a lot of discovery stuff.
Right.
And then you go to legal aid, where you're seeing, you know, 5 new clients a day, and it's, you know, I don't care about all that. Here is an hour's worth of things that have happened to me that are bad, and can you do something with them?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like real world problems, which was totally up my alley.
Right.
Really enjoyed legal aid. I really enjoyed working there, and it was a lot of fun. While I was at UF, the university had hired a legal historian, and after I'd been working there for a couple of years, I walked over to her office one day and said, I understand you do legal history. I would like to do legal history. And she was kind enough to take me on as a student. And I worked and did my coursework and dissertation at the same time and finished up in 2011. And then I got the
And that job. Was a degree in history, a PhD in history?
PhD in history, yeah. I picked up a master's while I was there.
Right.
Yeah. Fortunately, I did get some course credit for having a JD. So mm-hmm. it took a bit of the edge off. But, I got it done in 7 years. And
which is pretty much the standard time.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were out working. Well, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of lawyers out there who think of that as sort of something they'd like to do is go back to school and spend the time there. But what you did is you found yourself a job where mm-hmm. that was a possibility. It was quite convenient. And moreover, I'm guessing mm-hmm. that there was some sort of tuition discount.
Yeah, a lot of things. Or to back up, yeah, I was kind of one of those lawyers. You know, the law has a lot of attraction to a lot of us, but sometimes you find yourself kind of doing things that don't really comport with why you wanted to go there to begin with. You know, the kind of the intellectual exercise of the law, and so it really worked out for me in that I had this job in law, but it's non-billable, so it's just salary. My director was really great and really generous. You know, most grad classes are kind of night classes anyway, so it wasn't
right.
I wasn't missing that much work. But you don't get that off the ground without having a boss that is cool with it.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And when you're in private practice, as you were hinting, the mm-hmm. billable hours requirement means you're literally counting your day in 6-minute increments. Uh-huh. And if you miss 6 minutes today, you've got to add it to tomorrow's quota. And it's just this constant pressure. I used to do some commercial litigation back in the day, civil litigation broadly. And that was always the pressure. It was always in the back of your mind. I've got to get this done. So mm-hmm. I certainly can see why you're doing it. So now you're an academic. You're here at yes. the University of Tennessee in Knoxville.
Yes.
Down the street from Lincoln Memorial University's mm-hmm. law school where we are today. And that's, of course, where our paths cross because mm-hmm. you teach both at the law school and in the history department. And I think it was last summer when I was at UT, I sent out my usual summer solicitation. Hey, is anybody working on anything interesting? And you responded, and you're working on something that's really interesting.
Well, I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for having me
on. It's all about a wharf.
It's all about the mud in the bottom of Baltimore Harbor.
Well, that just sounds fascinating.
I know. For all our listeners out there, that's going to be one that they're going to rip the dial off.
I must say that of the canon of constitutional law courses, and this one is definitely in it, it's a case called Barron versus Baltimore. Extremely important case. Right. But it's not one that I would have thought of as justifying a book of its own simply mm-hmm. because it doesn't have the sexy factor. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a Marbury versus Madison. It's not a Dred Scott case. It's not a Korematsu case. Mm-hmm. Again, it's about a wharf, and we'll get to those details in a minute. But as you point out in your book, the title of which is Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore and the Foundations of American Liberty, this was an extremely pivotal case in our constitutional mm-hmm. history. So, and it had to do with the establishment mm-hmm. of our concept of rights or constitutional rights. Having said that now, I'm going to suggest that we hold off on Barron versus Baltimore and we start at a much more fundamental level. What do you mean by a right? What is a right?
Part of this I talk about in the book is when you even use the concept or the term right, it's almost elemental. You know, you wouldn't split that atom any further. Well, I have a right to do this. I have a right to do that.
I know my rights.
Right, right. Yeah. Anything is a right. And if we think about rights, I mean, in especially the Anglo-American legal tradition, it's got a much longer pedigree. You know. If you think of even the term right itself going back to English common law, it's generally considered something that has to do initially with realty. Mm-hmm. And you
property law?
Yeah, as property professors say. It's
our colleague right. over at the University of Florida, Greg Stein, would agree with you. He insists. I interviewed him some time ago about Chinese property law, and I was kidding him about how boring property law is. And he goes, no, it's great stuff. It's the foundation of all of our rights. And so I think Greg's going to be gratified by this. But go on, please.
Yes, yes. He's at UT, by the way. I think he's at Florida. Which
did I say Florida? Yeah. I was thinking of Florida. Of course
yeah,
he's at UT,
yeah.
Right down the street,
Greg
of course.
Might correct us. No,
I'm sorry, yeah.
No, absolutely. I threw that in for Greg because I know he likes property. No, I mean, I think it does come from that. So if we think of stuff that we would think of as rights today, generally more referred to as something like a privilege or a liberty. And you have this conceptual move that happens over time where rights seem to get crossed with things like liberties. And so you take the conceptual notion of a liberty, of a freedom in some way, and you fuse it with a property notion of a right into something now, a freedom that you indeed possess.
Yes, you know? And it starts getting really vague because, you know, liberty, right, freedom, all of these things come in together. Let's go back to property for just a moment, and I'm going to think back all the way to my first year property course. When I was first taught what it means to own a piece of property, I was the expression that almost every property teacher will use is ownership is a bundle of rights. And perhaps chief among them is the right to exclude others. So mm-hmm. if I own Blackacre, if I own this piece of property, mm-hmm. what does that mean? It means that I can say to the world, stay out. I can put a fence up and say, this is mine and it's not yours. And then there are other rights as well, you know, the right to exploit the resources on the property, right. Et cetera, et cetera. And then those, of course, are balanced against various societal obligations, perhaps the necessity of paying taxes on the property, those sorts of things. But in that concept, it seems to me that a right is perhaps better described as a power. You have a certain power to do things against the world, okay? And so we can introduce yet another concept in here, liberty, right, power, freedom. Now, yeah. I hope I haven't muddled things up, but if that's the genesis of all of this, then from the very beginning, you've got all these concepts sort of bundled together.
Yeah, and I think bringing up power is accurate because, I mean, you know, it is all about power. I mean, you know, what does constitutional government require? You know, that there's some agreed limits on the government. I mean, one way to do so is to write it out in a constitution and say, you know, the legislature can do this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. Another way to do it is, you know, to give either persons, institutions, or individuals rights, which also operate as checks on power, mm-hmm. you know, and so power, I think, is at the base of all of this.
Okay. Yeah. So it starts with property.
Yeah.
It's developed in the English common law.
Mm-hmm.
Where does it go from there? What are the other sources of rights?
Well, that's where it gets interesting. There's a big historiographical debate in the 1700s in the United States, especially in and around the Revolution. For example, Jack Rakove has done a number of great pieces on this where he says, you know, if the Americans are seeking some kind of disassociation with the English and they want a basis for which to do that, you know, the English common law gets kind of less and less attractive for a number of reasons. And so you start finding rights in not only kind of extra-legal, fundamental law, natural right, things that in some ways are growing out of either kind of religious kind of bases or even growing out of kind of the international law movement, Grotius and Pufendorf and
oh,
such.
Oh, my.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm speaking with William Davenport Mercer of the University of Tennessee, who's written a book, Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore, and the Foundations of American Liberty. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Bill Davenport. Stick around. So once again, we're in the Potter Studios at Montpelier at the Center for the Constitution, and across me, dressed impeccably, is Doug Smith, the director of the Center of the Constitution. How the heck are you, Doug?
I'm much better now that I'm with you, Stuart.
Well, we're just better together.
We are.
We're better together.
Peanut butter and chocolate.
And what's really endearing about this is that Raquel and Sean have their noses pressed to the glass of the studio. They're quite literally done watching us do this. So hello, Raquel and Sean. It's just a party today at the Potter Studios. Do you have quizzes for us?
I sure do. I've got a quiz question today, and it's a great one.
A great one. Well, do we have a contestant?
Is there? Yes.
Oh, we do. Who is this on the line?
Jennifer Perkins.
Jennifer Perkins. Where are you from, Jennifer Perkins?
London, Kentucky.
London, Kentucky. And do you listen to us online?
No, actually, I'm a former student of Stewart's.
Are you really? You're for heaven's sake, Jennifer. Hello. It's nice to see you.
When
did you graduate?
2008.
Oh, it's so long ago. Wow. My gosh, almost 10 years ago.
Has it been lucrative? That's the real question.
Well, I've been a public defender for going on 8 years now.
Well, nice.
It's not lucrative at all, but I'm very proud of you for your public service.
Thank you very much
for
your public service on behalf of all people. That is wonderful.
Indeed. It's always so nice. And I forgive me for not recognizing your name right off the bat. I've had well over 1,000 law students in the last few years, so I apologize. But it is nice to hear from you again. It's nice to hear that you're doing good work. And it was very gratifying for you to respond to our request over Facebook. So, Doug, do you have a question for Jennifer?
I sure do, Jennifer. I'm going to read a question and give you four choices. Are you ready?
Sure.
If an admiral knocks at your door and instructs you to feed and house 3 sailors, do you have to do it?
Excuse me. An admiral comes to my front door. Could you not think of a more realistic scenario than an admiral? Is he wearing his dress uniform?
There are members of the Navy who come from London, Kentucky. Thank you.
Oh, okay. All right.
An admiral comes and knocks at your door and instructs you to feed and house 3 sailors. Do you have to do it? A, yes, because that's the maritime law.
Ooh.
B, no. You can send them to the Courtyard Marriott. You are protected by the Third Amendment. Forcing you to house troops is intolerable. C, yes, according to Article 1, Section 8, feeding the sailors fits the definition of maintaining a navy.
Mm.
Or is it D, yes, you can say to the admiral that the Third Amendment applies only to militia, but that you understand that they have to come in.
All right. You got choices A through D. Jennifer, any idea?
I feel like I'm going to get this wrong, and I feel like my husband's going to kill me because he's ex-Air Force and knows all this stuff. So I'm going to go with A.
Which one?
A would be yes, because it's the maritime law.
The maritime law. But do you practice maritime law, Jennifer?
I do not. I'm just vaguely trying to remember from 10 years ago.
You're vaguely trying to remember from, because you took constitutional law from me, right?
I did.
Okay, did we ever talk about maritime law?
Maybe.
It's always so gratifying when students remember every single thing we talk about in class. It's just very, very gratifying.
This feels like the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald right here.
Is there any constitutional provision that you remember that would prevent you from being required to allow these troops to stay at your home?
Not off the top of my head. I really don't remember. It seems like from what I remember that, I don't know, maybe it's just a Southern girl in me that's like, no, that's the right thing to do.
You claim to be a public defender, and you're simply going to, it's the right thing. Well, Judge, it's the right thing to do to cooperate with the police, right? So, right. So send my client to jail. All right, Doug.
No, of course not that.
Well, of course not that.
Well, Jennifer, the answer is B, no. You can send them to the Courtyard Marriott. You are protected by the Third Amendment. There's no quartering of troops.
Jennifer, the only thing I can say in your defense is that we didn't actually talk about the Third Amendment in our con law class.
Okay, well, I feel better then.
The Third Amendment is the anti-redcoat amendment. It's often called the prohibition of the quartering of troops, which was, of course, one of the things that led to the revolution. I saw what you did there, Duck. You called it intolerable, yes.
Yeah. You like that?
One of the so-called intolerable acts. But
everyone in Boston will love that.
Yeah, indeed they will. Indeed they will. And it's a very obscure amendment. We've mentioned it a couple of times because it is so obscure. But it's not something taught in most con law classes, so I'm going to give you a pass on that. But we will send you a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, and you can check us on this. Just flip to the part that talks about the Third Amendment.
Okay, thank you.
And in the meantime, you know all about the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Go out and defend all those people who've been accused of heinous crimes and defend our Constitution for us. Okay, thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks. Thanks you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week we're discussing a seminal case in constitutional history. It's called Barron versus Baltimore. If you've never heard of it, you're not alone, because outside of constitutional law classes and scholarly circles, not many people talk about it these days. But they should. On its surface, it's about water, and it's about a wharf in Baltimore in the early 1800s. What could be less interesting and relevant today? Well, William Davenport Mercer of the University of Tennessee is telling us that this case is extremely relevant today, and that far from simply talking about boats and harbors, it really was, it marked a search for how we even define the concept of a right in American law.
To restate this, so someone who's an American who wants a definition of rights no longer wants to tether himself to the English common law. So I'm going to look elsewhere. Now, you've used several terms there. You mentioned religion, okay? So if something comes from God, well, we might call that a divine right.
Sure.
Okay? If something comes from nature, I have this vision in my head of Pan running around in the forest fluting, here's a right for this and a right for that. I never really understand exactly where natural laws come from. Maybe from trees. I don't know.
Right.
But the idea is that it just comes from nature, that it's inherent, and being a human being, perhaps, is another way of describing it. And then you reference this rather amorphous thing called international law, which I insist really doesn't exist, but others would differ, and quite honestly, it exists, but it's a very different animal from the sort of law that we might have in a given nation. It's really a matter of treaties and norms and all those sorts of things. So there are all these other areas that people will simply kind of pick and choose from, you're saying.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's real range of sources and rights and especially in the United States, or what becomes the United States. As other scholars have noted, you have this sense of power and of what power can do and not do emerging in the United States, or the colonies, excuse me, that's very different from England. You know, the Americans are very much still in kind of the English mode of thought, say in the 1600s when they're battling the Stuart kings, whereas the English themselves have largely moved on. Parliament is sovereign, whereas in the United States you've got a different view of power and a different view of rights, and the break with England gets this vast array of thought going about where do these come from. My thought is that people in the early Republic, while they have fewer sources of rights that they're pulling from, they have this tradition. And whether they think that some people are being maybe intellectually dishonest in the Revolutionary Age when they're making these claims doesn't mean that folks 20, 30, 40 years later don't take it at face value and believe it themselves.
Okay, so we've got this amorphous concept that's called a right.
Yeah.
We seem to understand in a gut level that it's an important thing, but there's no single definition of it. There's not even a single agreement on a single source of where this thing comes from. And so all of this is swirling around as we have our revolution and as we started developing our own separate American identity, and specifically a legal identity, maybe a philosophical identity. But then we go ahead and we have ourselves a constitutional convention, and we have ourselves a constitution, 1787, ratified 1788, starts to operate in 1789, and now we finally get to the period you're studying, the early federal period, when our federal government is first functioning. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to actually implement this thing we call the Bill of Rights, which was really part of the process of the ratification of the original Constitution a couple of years later in 1791. So now we've got all this constitutional structure in place. We've got this new government. And then Barron versus Baltimore comes along. Mm-hmm. So what was this case all about?
Sure. At a basic level, it's, two wharf owners, John Barron and John Craig.
What year was it?
It finally gets to the court in 1833.
1833. So this is like the first several decades.
Absolutely.
Kind of middle of the early 19th century. The big issue at this time that most people who study this era would be thinking about would be slavery. Hmm. This has nothing to do with that. This has to do with a more fundamental issue of nation building and how our nation's going to be structured and it's going to work.
Yes, although I think some of those larger issues are, while tangential, I think are there.
Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to get a year in there. Okay, so it's 1833.
Yeah, 1833, and for those who are maybe Supreme Court kind of history buffs, it's Marshall's last constitutional opinion. He dies in 1835, so this comes at the end of his very, very long, very storied career.
Okay, very brief synopsis. Yes. John Marshall, appointed by John Adams, mm-hmm. and at the height of right around the time of the Jeffersonian takeover. He becomes what he's often called the first great Chief Justice, even though he was our fourth Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. Most known for Marbury versus Madison, judicial review, the power of the Supreme Court. He's a nationalist. He's a guy who believes in a strong central government, a member of the Federalist Party, perhaps the last great Federalist. Mm-hmm. And he was young. He was in his 40s mm-hmm. when he's appointed. He sits on the court for decades. And lots of other important decisions out there as well.
Oh, yeah.
But you're saying this is toward the end of the career.
This is, and I think that makes all the difference. I mean, timing not only in his historical trajectory, but kind of the trajectory of the entire country. So here are the nuts and bolts of just the basic facts. John Barron, John Craig, two wharf owners in Baltimore. In the immediate aftermath of the War of 1812.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again. Yeah. What's a wharf owner? What the heck is a wharf owner?
Oh, sure. Two guys own essentially two large piers that stick out in Baltimore Harbor that they make their money by charging ships to tie up and load and unload.
And that's such a basic thing, but most people today probably don't even know what a wharf owner is. I mean, I'm sure they still exist.
Right.
There are people who own wharfs and they operate them. And let's give you more fundamental. I think I mentioned to you once before that my first job out of law school was working for the chief counsel at the Army Corps of Engineers. And I had never thought about harbors until that point. Mm. But unless you've got a wonderful natural harbor that's nice and deep right up to the shoreline, you've got an issue getting big ships up to the shore where you want to load and unload them because typically you're going to have a slope in the underwater area. Mm. And so it's too shallow close in. And so how do you unload a big ship? Well, you basically take the land out to it by building a wharf and take it out to deep water. You can tie your ship up there and then unload your goods and take them on the wharf into the harbor. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so these guys have gone out and bought themselves a piece of land along the harbor's edge. Mm-hmm. They built themselves a wharf, and now they say, okay, ship captains, come here and tie up, and we'll charge you money.
Right, our wharfage.
Wharfage.
Our wharfage. Yeah. Yeah.
I've never heard that expression.
Wharfage, yeah. Wharfage. I learned all sorts of things about wharfs that I never knew before.
Okay.
But the thing, it's very much a Baltimore story because, I mean, Baltimore is if you've ever been there, it's very steep. I mean, the grade is enormous. Mm-hmm. And if you think of Baltimore itself, they tried this initially in the inner harbor, today where the Orioles are and downtown and stuff. And they just couldn't keep it from filling up because all that water brings dirt and debris and sediment with it and constantly raises the floor, which means you can't bring the biggest ships in.
Another huge issue. You can have a wonderful harbor. Mm-hmm. But then it gets filled up with silt.
Absolutely.
Okay, it's being fed by rivers. The rivers bring in dirt. And so over time, as you say, the floor raises. In fact, one of the big things the Army Corps of Engineers was founded to do was to improve rivers and harbors. And primarily in a harbor, you go in with a great big dredge, yeah, and you just dredge out channels in that harbor, and then you're constantly going back and re-dredging them because they're always filling up with
always,
silt.
Okay. Always. And it's the same thing here. Now, these guys have a little bit of an advantage in that they buy in Fells Point, which at the time is about a mile – still is a mile east. They don't pick it up. Mile east of downtown, sticks out into the Patapsco River further upstream, so it has less less silting problems. Today it's the big tourist district. Mm-hmm. And so they in the aftermath of the war, they go, they buy this place, they improve it, and they start doing business. And so far, so good. The problem for them and what gives us the case is that the city is growing almost overnight. I mean, Baltimore, around this time, you know, shortly after the turn of the century, becomes the third largest city in the country. I mean, it really was insignificant for most of the 1700s. So it's almost blinked itself into existence overnight. Muddy streets, or the idea that water just pours through Fells Point to the point that they even had accidental lakes being created in the middle of the district.
Oh, my.
The city, look, is the third largest city in the country, as some, you know, a prime economic engine for the new country. Look, we got to do something about this. So they decide to fix the drainage problem, though. They make one embankment that runs it down one street. They build another embankment. It then moves that down another street. Long and short of it is they then take all the water that was pouring through Fells Point and funnel it into the river at one spot that just so happened to be right north of Barron and Craig's.
Right up river from them.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, boy. Right north of it. So all the water and all the sand and all the silt and debris.
And I'm guessing all the excrement from the city.
And all the gross stuff,
yeah,
that,
okay,
you can imagine, yeah, is parking around Baltimore in the late 18-teens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's probably pretty foul.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so they, of course, they lose their shirt. They're not alone.
Wait a second. They lose their shirt. Why? What happens when all that water flows in?
It makes it so you can't park the big ships.
Because it silts up everything.
Absolutely.
It's changed the water flow, and that's
the
key here.
It. Yeah.
We've got this harbor bottom. You've got this river bottom.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be a certain depth in order for the wharf to be attractive to a ship owner, for the ship to come up. Everything's working fine. These guys, Barron and Crane, was it?
Craig.
His partner's name, are making money.
Mm-hmm.
And then the city of Baltimore comes in and changes the flow. And the next thing they know, the ships can't get up to their wharf because it's changed the flow pattern. And now it's silting up there. Or at least that's their claim.
Absolutely. And we don't need to be charitable to the city on that. The city admitted it. They said,
oh, really?
So oh, yeah.
So everybody agreed. This is
everyone
what was
agreed.
Happening.
And it's the classic case that you see in many constitutional law decisions where you have the competing interest. You know, one interest, you have individual rights, and the other interest is the city being able to use its police power, the state power, but they're a municipality of the state. And so there's no question as to what happened, but the city is essentially saying, look, what do you expect us to do? Just leave this alone?
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is William Davenport Mercer, the author of a new book, Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore and the Foundations of American Liberty. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Bill, or at least we'll finish the first part of it, because it turns out this is so interesting, we're going to have to make this a two-parter. We also have a stack quote coming on with a more modern context. Stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And in case you're just joining us, I'll mention that this week we're talking about an older case. It's from 1833. It's called Barron versus Baltimore. And on its surface, at least, it's all about a wharf in Baltimore Harbor and silting up the harbor and whether the wharf owners had a claim against the state of Maryland. All interesting enough, but seemingly a little bit out of date. I mean, who really cares about water rights and wharfs back in the 1800s? It turns out that Barron versus Baltimore is an extremely important case in our constitutional history on a very theoretical level. It actually addresses how we in this country thought and continue to think of rights.
And I look in Baltimore itself and in across the city, people are either happy or upset about these changes. I mean, they improve the inner harbor in a number of ways. So a lot of people are happy. A lot of other people aren't. The other wharf owners that are near Barron and Craig in Fells Point, also not happy. The people that don't have to walk through muddy streets anymore, I presume, very happy.
Right.
So there's a question of a city needs to get bigger. It needs to kind of up its game with respect to its police power and the health and safety and welfare of its residents. But the question is who has to pay for that? You know, and Barron and Craig feel like the point's dry and we're out of business. Mm-hmm. So someone probably should pay us for this, you know. And that's the genesis of the claim. It doesn't bounce right to the Supreme Court, of course. They file
before we get there, what we typically will describe the situation as is a case of inverse condemnation. That's the modern term.
Yes.
Now let's explain that. The sovereign, the government, has the power to take our land. And in fact, the entire idea goes back all the way to the English common law and back into the mists of time. And the idea is that the king is the highest owner of property. In fact, that's what eminent domain means. Mm-hmm. It means that the highest form of property ownership is in the king. In some sense, the king owns everything. And the rest of us own our property only at the king's sufferance. Mm-hmm. And so the king can take our property at any time. And typically, the king would take your property or the government would be to do things like harbor improvements, right, drainage improvements, or roads or bridges or whatever. The Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which you're about to get to, mm-hmm, says, sure, fine, that, you know, that's still a power of the government, but if the government takes your property, you have to get reasonable compensation for it. Mm-hmm. So that's the only gloss that the U.S. Constitution put on that power of eminent domain. Mm-hmm. Now, in this particular circumstance, as we said, it was not a straight condemnation. It was an action by the government that may have involved taking other property where they built those berms and where they built their channels. You know, and they may have actually paid the people whose property they took to do those drainage improvements. But what Barron and Craig are arguing is that in doing that, they effectively destroyed at least some of the value of Barron and Craig's property, mm-hmm, effectively condemning it, even though they didn't actually take the property. And therefore, it boils down to pay us.
Right. If they were later in time, they would be screaming about regulatory takings.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
Absolutely.
I mean, today, if somebody might do that, you might impose a zoning requirement on some piece
absolutely
of property, and then the property owner will say, well, wait a second, now you've just destroyed 50% of the value of my property. Mm. Pay me.
Right.
So it's a similar sort of thing.
Right. They don't quite have as easy a remedy as we would today, and for numbers of reasons. What's interesting, though, is that their first move is not to the Fifth Amendment. Mm-hmm. Their first move is to file suit in county court in Baltimore and bring a common law action for what they refer to as trespass on the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit of a kind of an omnibus cause of action that covers all sorts of negligence type suits. No constitutional angle to it whatsoever.
Just sort of a common law, you've taken my property. What I might do if you come on my property.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
You've trespassed on my property. You've damaged it, so I'm suing you, Bill.
Absolutely.
And they're treating the city of Baltimore like two private litigants
absolutely
might treat each other.
And if you think, you know, where are their rights coming from? Well, for Barron and Craig and for their attorneys, well, I have a common law. I have a common law right to not have my property destroyed by you. And if you destroy it, you have an obligation to compensate me for it. And they file suit. delays in litigation are not a modern thing. They file in 1822 and finally win, but it's not until 1828.
They won on the common law.
They win. They win. The trial judge is incredulous that the city, so you admit to this, you did it. I don't really care, city, that you feel that your actions weren't done with any sort of malicious intent, or that you were doing it according to your duty. Justice in the judge's mind seems to be, if you damage someone's property, you ought to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting, in this I found fascinating, that Justice Stevenson Archer of the Baltimore County Court, his opinion is printed up in a magazine, The American Jurist, that gets as much or more mentions in judicial opinions in the early decades than Marshall's Barron opinion.
Really?
It gets, yeah. I mean, and also, keep in mind, this is the age where, state court judges carried a lot of sway.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he's not Lemuel Shaw. He's not coming from the Supreme Court of that state. But I get the sense that there's not the idea that it's the Supreme Court or nothing.
Okay, thousands of people are now asking Bill, "Who the hell is Lemuel Shaw?"
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
One of the giants of the age, a Supreme Court justice for Massachusetts,
right.
And
okay.
And really, really kind of really set the tone in ways that many Supreme Court decisions didn't. We go back and mind the Supreme Court decisions because we consider, well, if it's the Supreme Court, that's the most important one.
But there are lots of prominent judges out there.
Absolutely.
From the state court system, and he was one of them.
Especially if you're not really considering rights as coming from the Constitution preeminently, you're not really going to look to the Supreme Court for rights cases.
Okay, so yeah. That's who Lemuel Shaw is.
Sorry about
that. Perfectly all right. We got to clarify occasionally.
Yeah, I dig it.
So you got this case. I'm thinking, okay, what's the problem? They've won their case, and Baltimore pays them, right?
No.
I know.
Well, fortunately for me, they don't. They appeal. They appeal to Annapolis.
To the state Supreme Court.
To the state Supreme Court. Now, what's interesting in all of this is in between the time they file the case in 1822 and by the time it gets to the trial and especially into appeal, the city recognizes that this could be a problem for them, and they bring on additional attorneys. One of those attorneys that they bring on is Roger Tawney, who ultimately for
making his name before he becomes Chief Justice and perhaps the most infamous in history in the Dred Scott decision.
Before he obliterates his good name in Dred Scott, mm-hmm. and with Merriman, he's considered an excellent attorney, especially in Baltimore. And the city brings him on to supplement the city's solicitor. And so Tawney makes the appearance in the case as well. So they appeal it to Annapolis. Everyone heads down there. And in a pretty terse opinion, really, that just said, overruled, Barron and Craig lose. And they're now out of options, at least as it goes in the state system. That's where they then decide the Supreme Court is where we're gonna go next. Now, what's interesting is Marshall signs the order.
Wait a second, but had they raised the constitutional issue in the state court case? I mean, you had described it as being a straight trespass case.
Oh, yeah.
That's what was confusing me. It's very sketchy.
But
we don't have any record of them having raised the Fifth Amendment issue in the state court
it's
case.
It's very sketchy, yes.
Generally speaking, if you don't raise an issue, then you're not going to be able to appeal on the basis of that issue. Or maybe you can try, but it's going to be very, very hard to do so. But okay, we don't even know if they raised the issue in the state court.
Yeah, well, so in the trial court, it's all common law. In the appeals court, it starts to get a bit natural law-ish. And I think part of that has to do with who they select as their attorney. So, for example, the early stuff in the trial, they have a local attorney, Charles Mayer, very good Baltimore attorney. They bring on a guy by the name of David Hoffman. David Hoffman is interesting in that he is one of the earliest legal educators in the country who is trying to make law and legal education not something that you would just, you know, apprentice under a practicing attorney, maybe transcribe some documents, read Blackstone, but to say that it's a vocation and something that requires a classical education. So he has this academy that opens up under the kind of the auspices of the University of Maryland. And so Hoffman's considered one of the country's first real kind of legal educators in a modern form. And he's Barron and Craig's co-counsel. And so when you get to the appellate court, he gets very natural law about the whole thing. He starts citing, you know, Roman history.
Oh, man.
Livy.
So they bring the egghead in, and the egghead starts bringing all these classical references, and so we don't even know what we're talking about anymore.
It's all over the place. but what's interesting is, you know, you go from common law as a source of right. By the time you're in the appeals court, you're going into, like, fundamental law or natural law natural right that you know, the Livy piece, the Roman piece. But even in times of war, when Rome would need property, they would at least make some provision to pay the guy for it. You know, how dare you?
So they were bringing up rights, even if they weren't specifically citing the Fifth Amendment.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So they've been
absolutely
doing this down at the Maryland level, and then they bring it up to the Supreme Court.
Marshall signs it in 1831. The writ of error, the thing that would bring it to the court, meaning that he wants it, and I think there's a real critical timing to all of this. So if Marshall wants this case, it's a rights case.
He wants to say something with it.
He wants to say something with it, but he wants to say something with it in 1831. I think by the time he gets it in February of 1833. I don't think he wants it anymore. I think things have changed. And I think the timing of when this hits the court is pretty critical.
Okay, please. What did he want? Well, what changed?
Well, in between then, you've got two big crises. First one, you've got Indian removal. Mm-hmm. You've got the Cherokee cases.
Yeah.
You know, so
Andrew Jackson.
Absolutely. So what happens, just in a nutshell, Georgia is hacked off. Georgia is upset. They feel that the feds are not complying with the deal that they agreed to decades ago. In 1802, Georgia cedes its western land claims to the federal government. But part of the deal was that the federal government would use its best efforts to extinguish the claims of the Cherokees within the state of Georgia in exchange for the western lands becoming federal common lands.
Lands that would later become Alabama.
Absolutely.
And Mississippi.
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. The problem, though, is that several presidential administrations come and go, and the Cherokee have not gone anywhere. It's really the policy of the federal government to pursue this kind of assimilation policy. Which of course is you know, reflects the limits of its age, but the Cherokee learns some hard lessons from their past dealings with the Americans, and in many ways embrace that model, and it puts a real strain on the Georgians. The Cherokee transcribe their own language. They have their own newspaper. Mm-hmm. They welcome missionaries in to provide Western-style education. Most notably for our purposes, they create a constitution that mm-hmm. delineates its boundaries, mm-hmm. announces its sovereignty. So from Georgia's perspective, yeah. You're like, wait, this is actually going in reverse of what we wanted.
Oh, I hate to interrupt Bill Mercer. For those of you who are just joining us, I'm speaking with William Davenport Mercer of the University of Tennessee, and he's telling me about his fascinating book about Barron versus Baltimore, a seminal case from the early 1800s that had a lot to do with what we think about rights and what rights are here in the United States in our constitutional context. We'll finish our discussion with Bill next week. It was such an interesting one that we went much longer than I thought. So we're going to stretch it out over two episodes. And that leaves us with just a few minutes for a stack quote from Library Anne. This one takes us up a couple of hundred years to talk about a fellow you might have heard of. I think his name is Vladimir.
Today's stat quote comes from David Satter, an expert on Russia. You've probably heard of or from him. He is currently a journalist and senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a fellow of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Satter has written about Russia for nearly four decades and has the distinction of being the first American journalist to be expelled from Russia since the Cold War. That was in December of 2013. The book I'm reading from today was published in 2016, entitled The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. This book was published by the Yale University Press and is available through our My iLibrary ebook subscription. The book begins with a discussion of Putin's rise to power. In 1999, there were a series of apartment bombings throughout Russia that were blamed on Chechen rebels. At the time, Vladimir Putin was the prime minister and vowed revenge, stating, "We will pursue the terrorists everywhere. If they are in an airport, then we are in an airport. And forgive me, if we catch them in the toilet, then we'll rub them out in the toilet." During Putin's inaugural address in 2000, he said, "The head of the Russian government was always and will always be the person who answers for everything." Ostensibly, Russia is a democracy that answers to the people. In fact, the Russian Constitution does not state that the president will answer for everything. The parliament is responsible for making laws, and the courts are responsible for the administration of justice, which is very similar to our own three-branch system of government. However, the government's power structure does not sound like it is held in check by a system of checks and balances. Satter explains Putin's government in a chapter entitled The Power Vertical. Under Putin, power has been delegated to a bureaucracy that answers only to the country's leader. Putin has created a vertical chain of command and eliminated alternative centers of power by appointing the highest posts with friends he worked with while he was at the KGB and the FSB. By 2004, all of the top ministers, half of the Security Council, and 70% of the senior regional officials in Russia came from the security service colleagues Putin formerly worked with. Satter explains, like most Soviet citizens, many of Russia's leaders grew up in poverty, living, as Putin did, in communal apartments with shared kitchens and baths. With no reason for success except Putin's patronage, they acquired wealth beyond the dreams of avarice and repaid the favor with total conformity. Satter goes on to explain that beside creating a system of top-down control, Putin acted to eliminate independent centers of power. One by one, institutions capable of providing an alternative to unitary power were subordinated, starting with the media, followed by business, and ending with parliament and the courts. The result was a society in which the regime was the only center of power, drastically limiting the freedom of the population. Here in the United States, we are living in a time of alternative facts and fake news. Putin was able to silence his media critics by simply taking control of them. One Russian TV network was acquired after the owner was arrested for fraud and later allowed to negotiate away his $473 million debt and a potential prison sentence in exchange for Putin's control over his network. Putin continued to neutralize any political dissent or negative political programming by taking control of the remaining two television stations. So take that, fake news. Interestingly, the court system was last on Putin's list of things to control. In Russia, Putin was reelected in 2008 and 2012 by a landslide. In 28 of the 83 regions, there was virtually no local opposition. And even if there had been, the election returns could have easily been falsified. For example, Satter reports that 99.48% of the recorded vote from Chechnya was in support of Putin. Satter goes on to say, the electoral results were reinforced by ballot box stuffing, multiple voting, and falsification of protocols. It was certain that the local judiciary would overlook these violations, because the court chairman positions, who were appointed by Putin, are responsible for setting the judges' vacation schedules and involved with influencing a judge's commission or dismissal. This is Library Anne with Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law with today's stat quote.
And And that's our show, part one of two, when we'll be talking to William Davenport Mercer about his new book, Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore, and the Foundations of American Liberty. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our stack quote is by Anne Walsh Long, also known as Library Anne. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.